Live from KCUR News, this is Casey Currents on Central Standard, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. At the beginning of the year, Kansas launched CanCare, the first fully privatized system for delivering Medicaid coverage. It was introduced as a way to cut costs, but some people are finding the cost cutting is coming at the expense of services.
It's essentially like the state is saying, you've got four apples that you need to have to survive, and we're willing to give you one apple.
Today on Casey Currents, we examine the new CanCare program. Is it meeting expectations? Then we visit a turkey farmer who's not that interested in feeding people.
The day we load them for Thanksgiving is traumatic for me. I hate it.
Plus, musician Janelle Monae talks about her KC roots. It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Welcome to Casey Currents. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. And now we're live, so you can call in and share your thoughts on some of the big issues in our community. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback promised that privatizing Medicaid would save the state money and provide more health care. But almost a year into CanCare, nearly 1 in 10 of the state's 380,000 Medicaid recipients are facing service cuts. On today's Casey Currents, we'll be looking into the new CanCare program in Kansas. Is it creating new efficiencies? We want to hear about your experiences with CanCare and Medicaid in general. Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or emailing caseycurrents at kcur.org. Before we get to our guests, Casey Currents' Alex Smith has the story of one Prairie Village man who says his service reductions could have devastating effects on him and his family.
Do New Jersey.
What's the capital of Kansas?
Topeka. It's early evening at the Buller's house in Prairie Village, and the two kids talk about school while their mother Ann serves dinner. On one side of the kitchen table, their dad, Finn, joins in the conversation from his motorized wheelchair with a wheezing ventilator attached to the back. A medical caregiver quietly slips in to give Finn an insulin shot for his diabetes. There's always a caregiver at the Buller's house, providing 24/7 medical help to the former Kansas City Star reporter. Finn Buller's was born with a rare degenerative disease called Charcot-Marie tooth. It's required a lot of complicated medical care, including the insertion of a breathing tube that changed the sound of his voice.
I tended to think I had a fairly commanding and sort of booming voice by which I could, put on the professional voice and, this is Finn Buller's with the Kansas City Star.
About 4 years ago, when Buller's was in his mid-40s, his health forced him to leave the Star. Caregivers now help him with dressing, making food, and bathing. They help clear phlegm from his airway a few times a day, and they move him at night when he sleeps to prevent bed sores.
These are non-negotiables.
That's Rocky Nichols. He's executive director of the Disability Rights Center of Kansas.
These are the things that people need to get out of bed in the morning to accomplish activities of daily living that those of us without disabilities take for granted every single day. And to see those services dramatically scaled back is very troubling.
Earlier this month, with the switch to CanCare, Finn Buller's found out his attendant care services are being cut 75%. And he's not alone. About 30,400 other CanCare recipients are receiving cuts to their Medicaid this year. These are the results of reevaluations conducted by the three companies that now manage the state's Medicaid program.
Part of their assessment or their reevaluation is to determine if the appropriate amount of services is occurring, if additional needs have been identified, or if a reduction in services is warranted.
Gina Meyer-Hummel is a commissioner of the Kansas Department of Aging and Disability Services. Finn Buller's Medicaid is now managed by United Healthcare. This summer, one of that company's care coordinators paid him a visit and asked him about his ability to function. Based on this information, United decided to cut 10 hours a day of in-home care. And at night, his care attendant will be replaced by someone who will sleep in the house to be available every few hours or for emergencies.
It's essentially like the state is saying, you've got four apples that you need to have to survive, and we're willing to give you one apple.
Whenever a managed care company wants to make a service reduction, it needs the okay from the Kansas Department of Aging and Disability Services. Neither United Healthcare nor the Kansas Department said they could talk about the specifics of Finn Buller's case, but KDAD's Angela DeRocca said the department is comfortable with the requested service reductions. Commissioner Gina Meyer-Hummel explains,
generally, reductions occur because there had been a level of service that had been approved that it's no longer necessary.
A lot of Finn Buller's care doesn't require a professional. It could be done by family members. But his wife works full-time and serves as the primary family breadwinner. The care reductions would require Ann to be Finn's nurse every minute she's not working or sleeping. They say that's just not practical.
My name is Lori Fisher. I'm a family physician that practices in Overland Park, Kansas.
Dr. Fisher has been Buller's doctor for over 10 years. She was not consulted when United reevaluated Buller's, and she disagrees with the company's decision.
I understand that there's concern about people misusing the health system or that certain people get more care than they probably truly need, but I really feel like Finn is a very appropriate candidate for 24-hour care and needs it to continue to be able to live.
What are you going to be jelly.
He's going to be peanut butter.
Back at the Buller's house, the conversation has turned to Halloween. But Finn has the next day, November 1st, on his mind. That's when the reductions are scheduled to begin. Finn Buller's has bought himself some time, though. He's appealing the reduction, and according to the Kansas Department of Aging and Disability Services, no changes will be made while there's a pending appeal. I'm Alex Smith, KCUR News.
Alex's story about Finn Buller's first ran here on KCUR at the end of October. Buller's services were supposed to be cut November 1st, but he's appealing the reduction and still receiving full services during that process. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. This is Casey Kearns, and we're back in the studio now with two guests who'll help us examine the implementation of Kansas's new privatized Medicaid program, the first in the nation of its kind. Medicaid is a state program providing health insurance for the poor and disabled. That's almost 400,000 people in Kansas who currently receive those services. The new CanCare program is supposed to save the state $1 billion over the next 5 years and provide better care. Dr. Susan Mosier is the director of Medicaid services at the Kansas Department for Health and Environment and overseeing CanCare now. Dr. Mosier, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Scott Brunner is senior analyst at the Kansas Health Institute and former Medicaid director. Welcome to Casey Currents.
Thank you.
Dr. Mosier, can you explain in a nutshell why has Kansas made this shift from Medicaid to CanCare?
What we had previously is we had for 2/3 of our population were in managed care with two managed care companies. And we have moved to increased choice for those individuals, as well as we've had behavioral health services and long-term services and supports, as well as waiver services moved into the managed care so that we can actually coordinate care across the different areas of health care for an individual. So an individual has behavioral health needs, physical health needs, waiver services needs, and there can actually be care coordination across the whole health spectrum for that patient.
So 2/3 of people who are in Medicaid in previous years were already in managed care programs?
That is correct.
And how do people know which program they will get on when they go on Medicaid or when they've been transferred over?
They have a choice of where they go. When we moved from the previous program to CanCare, we utilized an algorithm to match people with what seemed to make the most sense for them, which would be if they're in a nursing facility, that would be, you know, their primary caregiver, or if there was their PCP, their primary care physician. If they had family member needs that a particular MCO provider was with just one or two of the MCOs instead of all three. But then they had a choice period of a minimum of 90 days to switch, to look at all the programs and to look at what was best for them as an individual or they as a family, and they have that opportunity to change. And we are now entering the open enrollment period so that they can change again for next year.
So they were assigned an MCO or managed care organization, but then they had the opportunity to change.
That is correct.
And those three groups that are managing Medicaid now in Kansas are Amerigroup Kansas Inc., Sunflower State Health Plan, and United Healthcare Community Plan of Kansas. I want to bring Scott Brunner of the Kansas Health Institute into the conversation. How has your organization sort of been following this shift?
Our role is largely in helping explain the choice that Kansas Medicaid made moving to managed care to legislators and stakeholders in communities around Kansas, just to translate what Medicaid was like before and what it will be like as the transition to CanCare happens. We've also been trying to monitor enrollment, total enrollment in the Medicaid program over time, just to verify that there haven't been reductions or losses of people in the Medicaid program, which as the transition occurs. And I guess the last area we've been watching or monitoring is total spending. Since the transition to see if that is changing in the way that the state would expect.
Now, from your perspective, you ran Medicaid previously, and how big of a shift really is this? Dr. Moser just said 2/3 of people were already in managed care programs through Medicaid.
Well, it's a very significant shift, and as you've said earlier, that Kansas is the only state at the time, and it's one of the only states that's looking at moving the entire Medicaid population into risk-based managed care for all the services that they receive. And that's a very innovative approach and different in terms of how states choose to run their Medicaid programs. I'd say that Dr. Moser was absolutely right that most of the people in Medicaid before CanCare were in managed care, but most of the dollars that were spent were through the fee-for-service system of where you obtain a service from a provider, and the state would pay that claim. So the dollar change of management of the financial side of the program is a very significant shift with CanCare.
And Dr. Moser, just logistically, did this involve letting go a lot of the staff at the Department of Health and Environment, all the people that previously ran the Medicaid programs?
No, actually, we have changes in some of the work that people do from direct fee-for-service into managed care oversight, but basically they're not a reduction in the individuals.
So how is it saving the state money?
That's a very good question. And one of the things that we looked at is we wanted to take a long-term perspective on how to reduce or bend that cost curve down over time. So Medicaid costs have been rising in the state at about a 7.4% rate, and that's pretty consistent nationally. In fact, other states, some are up to 10%. And so when we're looking at that, we want to provide good quality care and maintain or improve the quality of care while bending the cost curve down. So costs will continue to rise as we have more individuals coming into Medicaid, but we will be providing that care through care coordination. And basically, one of the things that we took off the table was reducing eligibility. So anyone who was eligible last year in 2012 was eligible this year in 2013 for Medicaid. We did not reduce benefits for our members or beneficiaries. In fact, we added some services, including bariatric surgery, heart transplants, lung transplants, heart and lung transplants, as well as preventive dental for adults. We've had dental for children all along, but we hadn't had any dental services for adults for quite some time. So we were able to add those back. And then also not reducing payments to providers. So the floor was fee-for-service because we thought that would present an access issue if we had providers leaving Medicaid, and we wanted to make sure that we had good access for our beneficiaries. And so when you take those off the table, which are all short-term solutions, what you're left with is the two key
factors to reducing costs. One is care coordination, and that's really saying we have somebody who's looking at the whole person and their whole spectrum of services and making sure that they're getting the right care at the right time, that they're also not getting duplicative services, that if they're willing and able, that they can stay at home with home and community-based services instead of being in a long-term care facility.
Right.
The other thing that we're doing is putting an emphasis on preventive care. So if you think about the term health care, as a country, we've focused on care, the care of acute and chronic conditions. And what we want to do is shift to the health side and in emphasizing prevention, wellness, early detection, and early intervention. So
right.
That's part of what our care coordinators will do.
Dr. Moshe, I want to ask you a little bit more about that in a minute, but I want to tell people you're listening to KC Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Later this hour, we're going to visit a turkey farmer in Lindsberg, Kansas, who's preserving some rare breeds of heritage birds. But right now, we're talking about Kansas's new privatized Medicaid program called CanCare. And here with us are the program's director, Dr. Susan Mosier, and Scott Brunner of the Kansas Health Institute. Scott Brunner, I am wondering, what are you hearing from the people who were covered by CanCare now? Do you find that there are people who have been let go from the program or people who are receiving reduced services like Finn Bullers, who we heard from at the beginning of the hour?
As people have talked to legislative oversight committees and in the media, there's certainly examples of changes in care plans and service changes that have happened. That's, I think, largely to be expected in this kind of a transition and involving the three managed care companies in the service planning and kind of getting their feet on the ground. I don't know overall, at least the statistics the states published in their reporting to the federal government, there doesn't appear to be a reduction in the rate of spending there is, but not in the total amount of spending for Medicaid services. So it's a little hard to figure out whether there's actually a reduction or significant change in the number of services. But there are examples and some notable ones that you've already mentioned.
Well, we want to know from our listeners, are you affected by Kansas's move from Medicaid to CanCare? How has your care changed? Tell us at 816-235-2888 or on Twitter at KC Currents. We have a call here from Anna in Overland Park. Hi, Anna.
Hi, this is Anna. Sorry. I'm calling in to mention that, hold on, I'm somewhat distracted. I'm calling in as a case claims manager for a behavioral health provider. And I just wanted to say that CanCare actually is costing the state a lot more because they are paying at a lot higher rate than, say, our contracted rate with other insurers. So I guess that's my comment.
Was that true of Medicaid, too?
Excuse me?
Was that true of the previous Medicaid program, or has that been a shift this year?
I guess I'm unaware of that change because it's only recently that I've been in this position.
So, Dr. Mosier, why would Anna be observing that that CanCare is paying at a higher rate than other insurance providers?
That's a little bit surprising to me. And actually, I was a practicing ophthalmologist for 12 years, so Medicaid was one of the lowest reimbursing providers. So for the behavioral health provider there, I would think they would be happy with the with the payment reimbursement rates there.
For the office provider,
but
that
one
is
of
true,
the things,
but as also a taxpayer, it's kind of somewhat disturbing.
What I would like to look back is the traditional rates. As we said, the what we set was the floor was fee for service, and we wanted to not prevent or provide barriers to care by having providers leave Medicaid. And so there would be negotiated rates between each of the MCOs and each of the provider groups, which we do not get involved in that negotiation there. However, with what the negotiation that we have is with the MCOs for the capitated risk-based managed care payment is a per member per month, and they each have provided a discount off of the rate that we basically provided a savings off of the rate to us.
And Scott Brune, I wonder if that's what you're finding also at the Kansas Health Institute as you check in with different service providers, hospitals, and doctors. Oh, I think we lost Scott for a minute there. But Dr. Mosier, you mentioned that the that there's going to be somebody following each person's full medical care, and that will reduce costs because they'll be receiving, they'll pay attention to all of that person's needs and also to preventative health. I wonder, who is that person that's going to follow the a patient's full coverage?
Two things about that. One, that will be for individuals, you know, high needs individuals. So for someone like myself or probably many of our listeners, they don't need a care coordinator. You know, they're going in for an annual physical. So it's for those individuals that have more complex conditions, chronic diagnoses, diabetes, asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, things like that. But also what we are doing with the care coordination is there's an individual that can either be working for the MCO as a care coordinator. We also have targeted case management for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and they can keep their targeted case manager. Their targeted case manager is known to them and someone that typically they've had a relationship with for a long time, and that person will work with a care coordinator within the MCO and to provide the appropriate care for that patient.
We have a call here from Chris in Lenexa. Chris called 816-235-2888 or 816-235-2888. Hi, Chris. What's your question?
Good morning. I had a question. What was mentioned earlier is that that costs were going to remain pretty much the same, even, you know, with staffing and so on, and that basically it sounded like the cost reductions were going to come from greater efficiencies. What I guess my question is, there's an awful lot of publicity about people that are not getting the same level of care that they did before, and that this has really become more of a partisan program that has a real true beneficial program for the least, the lower end of the economic scale for Kansans. I'm just wondering how the good doctors kind of look at that as an argument against don't care.
Thanks. How they look at what as a good argument against that, the fact that people may be receiving a reduction in care?
Absolutely. I haven't heard anything positive about canned care, and it sounds to me it appears to be a real partisan driven type of agenda more than it is a true healthcare program.
Dr. Mosier, can you address that idea that this is a more partisan idea and not a health based idea?
Yes. Interestingly enough, one of the things that we had to do in order to make this change to CanCare is that we had to work really hand in glove with CMS, our Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services in Baltimore. And what we had to obtain was something called an 1115 waiver. And that waiver, basically each state has a state plan which says who's eligible, what benefits will they receive, and what is the grievance and appeals process, what is the state fair hearings process. And I just want to take a moment and say that for anyone on the reduction of care, I looked at the numbers last night, and the total number of reductions of plans of care across all three MCOs was a total of less than 100. So the reductions in care that we've seen, as we said, went through the approval process of the state. The vast majority of those changes then were looking at what that patient needed overall. And if that patient decided that they didn't agree with that, they have a grievance and appeals process within the MCO. They also have a state fair hearings. They can appeal directly to the state, and they don't have to go through the grievance and appeals process. They can come directly to the state. So so there's multiple opportunities.
And that's what Finn Bullers, who we heard from,
reviewed.
Right. That's what Finn Bullers, who we heard from at the beginning of the show, is doing. Scott Brunner of the Kansas Health Institute, do you have anything to add about that?
Well, I guess I'd just add to the comment about it being a partisan thing. The move in healthcare towards more coordinated care and trying to better utilize healthcare services and healthcare dollars isn't unique to Medicaid, isn't unique to Republican-controlled states or Democratic-controlled states. That's pretty much the model that public programs are moving to, and a lot of private insurance is moving to as well, to add that layer of care coordination, having somebody else look at the kinds of services that are provided, the amount and durations, and to try to make sure people are getting the right amount of services at the right time at the right place. So I don't know that it's as much of a partisan approach. It's pretty common in Medicaid programs around the country and a lot of parts of the Medicare program as well.
But perhaps the idea that programs that would be run better by a for-profit company than by the state may be something that's more partisan?
I wouldn't even agree with that. I think that the choice of how you get to care coordination, better care coordination, is the choice of that states and other payers will make. Some states have chosen to invest in state employees and other kinds of management approaches to achieve that goal. Kansas decided to go through a bid process and find private companies to do it. But I think the goal itself isn't the partisan one. I think, and then states have to make a choice about what the policy tool is they use to get there.
Well, if you are noticing changes in the new CanCare program in Kansas or thinking about what's in store for Missouri, let us know your thoughts at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 or on Twitter at Casey Currents. Dr. Mosier, people are reporting delays in authorization for services, and also service providers have been reporting delays in receiving payment from the new managed care organizations that are handling CanCare. And I wonder how you're looking at that and what you're hearing.
What we have is a very detailed oversight of our MCOs, and we also have the pay for performance measures. So one of the things that we do, for instance, you mentioned claims payment. We actually have weekly reports with specific down to individual provider issues of payment issues that we follow the MCOs and make sure that they are giving the appropriate services and resolving problems and issues that have come up. The second thing that we have is the pay for performance measures. And so we have process measures, and then next year we'll start having the outcome measures as well. And one of those is a pay for performance. So I also want to step back and just say, when we're talking about pay for performance, sometimes people think that the MCOs or the managed care organizations are receiving a bonus, and they are not. Basically, we had negotiated that, and they have to earn that back by meeting certain standards and exceeding certain standards. So contractually, they are obligated to pay all clean claims by 30 days.
So why did you withhold 3% this year?
We withheld that at the beginning, and then if they meet these measures, they can earn back. So this year there were 5 measures, and so for that 3%, basically the 3% is divided up, so it's say about 0.75% for each of the measures. And if they meet that performance goal, then they will receive that money that we withheld. So it's an incentive to perform to higher standards.
What performance goals were they not meeting?
One that is the one that you mentioned was the clean claims payment. And so we've been working with them on that particular issue. As I said, we get weekly reports, and we also speak with them in between on particular issues as they surface. The other thing that we have is for beneficiaries or providers, a no wrong door. So we want to be accessible. We can't solve a problem if we don't know about it. So if you go to the CanCare website at www.cancare.ks.gov, there are phone numbers there. There's phone numbers for help with enrollment. There's phone numbers for grievance and appeals. There's a phone number for the CanCare Ombudsman. There's also email, fax, you know, whatever way you'd like to contact us. But we are committed to the people of the state of Kansas to provide the best possible care. And so if there are problems, which we know, we've certainly heard about the ones that we know of, but if somebody is out there and they have a problem and they haven't contacted us, we just ask them to please do, because we do want to make this work for everyone.
And Scott Brunner, what are you hearing about this issue of delayed payments to providers and also delays in authorization for services for people who are having to wait longer times to get their services?
The same kind of press reports and things that have been reported in legislative committees that that you've already talked about, and it's certainly a concern. I listened to some of the calls that the state would host right at transition in January and for the weeks following the transition, and trying to understand what problems providers were having. Some of those issues seem to be resolved, or the listing of the problems indicates that they've been resolved, but there are still at least these lingering reports that there are payment issues.
And Scott, when do you think we'll know whether CanCare is working, whether it's saving the state money and providing better care?
But I think certainly at the end of the first year, when the states had the chance to look at all of the data the three plans are going to submit and look at their financial performance over the first year, there'll be some indications there of whether, in terms of total services delivered and paid for, whether the targets that were set up early in the contract are met. It's a little hard to tell in the first 6 months or so, over the first 6 months, given if payments weren't timely or weren't correct, just in the transition issues. But I think after, 12 full months of data and time to operate the program, there ought to be some early indications of whether the goals are being met.
Well, Scott Brunner is a senior analyst.
Can I just say one thing?
We just have about 10 seconds left.
Yeah, we were able to, with initial savings, apply $37 million to the waiting list. So we're able to have, we have waiting lists for individuals with physical disabilities and 400.
Dr. Mosher, thank you so much. I'm so sorry, but I have to stop you there because we have to move on. But Dr. Mosher is the Director of Medicaid Services at the Kansas Department for Health and Environment. Thank you for joining us. Scott Brunner is Senior Analyst at the Kansas Health Institute and former Medicaid Director. Thank you.
Thanks, Sylvia.
Today, we're launching a new segment called Tell KCUR. Each week, we're asking a question on the air, on Twitter, and on Facebook. You might have heard this week's question on the air. Joining us to talk about the question and answers we heard from our listeners is KCUR's community engagement reporter, Laura Ziegler. Thanks for stopping by KC Currents,
sure.
Laura.
Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. So tell us about this new project.
Okay. Well, it's a new feature that we're launching as part of our community engagement effort here at KCUR. And what we're trying to do is open the doors of the station and the digital space for you, open the doors of the station on air, that is, not physically, for you to not only tell us what you think about things, but down the road, hopefully, to be sources and collaborators as we try to inform and entertain you on a variety of topics. Of course, today you've been talking about CanCare or Medicaid expansion in Kansas. So we thought it was an opportunity to kind of throw out the broad query, what's the longest you've been without health insurance?
So what did you find?
Well, we heard back from a lot of people via our Twitter and Facebook and our callback line, and we had really a variety of responses, people who had been without insurance for decades and some who'd been without insurance for critical periods of their lives. But I'd say the overarching takeaway were from those of you who are living without or had been living without or are now living without health insurance is people are just trying to stay healthy at all costs and really hoping and praying that they just don't get sick.
Any specific answers?
Yeah. Lynn tweeted that she had had insurance for 10 years because she only had part-time work, and she's dealing now with a huge emergency room bill that she had from several years ago. Melissa wrote on Facebook, quote, "I didn't have good insurance when I was younger. I ended up owing a huge bill. I lived in a rural area, so my community didn't have good health care."
I have to stop you right there. Sorry.
Okay.
But Laura Ziegler is the KCR's community engagement reporter. Thanks for checking in. We'll be looking out for more from Tell KCUR. Coming up after the break, singer Janelle Monae tells how she started developing her unusual personal style in the secondhand stores of Westport. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. This Thanksgiving, millions of people will sit down to a traditional holiday feast. But that turkey you might have bought at the supermarket is not the same one as your grandmother used to buy. Few farmers in this country are still raising heritage turkeys. Those are the original turkey breeds that are more like their wild ancestors than today's modern turkey. KC Currents' Esther Honig recently visited with a poultry farmer in Lindsberg, Kansas, who's more interested in saving these birds than he is feeding people.
The like what's on this side of the fence, the dark with the gold and the white, and that's a bronze.
It's a warm fall day, and Frank Reese is showing me his heritage turkeys. Reese has lived on this small farm for the past 20 years. Behind his century-old farmhouse are the open-air pens where he keeps his birds.
And then these dead are silver with the black right there. That's Narragansett pattern. This is all Narragansett.
Reese wears a gray army hoodie and tucks his short hair under a baseball cap. He's a fourth-generation poultry farmer and raises five varieties of heritage turkeys, some found nowhere else in the world.
I mean, I really don't remember not loving poultry. I grew up on a family farm here in Kansas, and we were all given jobs at a very young age, and I got sent to the poultry barn.
As a young man, Reese was part of the 4-H club, where he learned to breed turkeys and other poultry for show.
I was state champion many times. I got to go to a lot of national shows. I just knew that that was part of what I was going to do, was also show poultry, and I wanted to show chickens, turkeys, ducks, geese, everything.
That's how Reese met his mentors, the great poultry breeders who helped found the turkey industry. They taught Reese how to handpick the right breeding turkeys and raise them.
Probably the most important there and at the last was Norman Kardosh. He's the one who taught me a lot, especially in the last 20 years.
But when Kardosh passed away in 2004, Reese made him a promise.
Then when he did go into the hospital for the last time, you know, and I went to see him, and he was crying, and he said, "I'll never see my turkeys again." And so I told him, I said, not only would I give the rest of my life to saving his turkeys, but I would try hard so that people wouldn't forget.
Reese opened Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch back in 1973. When most farmers switched to the new breeds of turkey that yielded more meat, Reese just stuck with the natural breeds he'd always known. He is now one of the largest producers of heritage turkeys in the U.S., and his turkeys have been recognized by chefs like Martha Stewart and Bobby Flay.
Usually they're quite shocked, you know, over the flavor difference. They had no idea that what turkey tasted like.
Because of their breed and natural lifestyle, roaming free, roosting, and eating bugs, these turkeys have more dark meat and a distinct taste, nothing like the commercial turkey.
The turkey today that you purchase, you know, from a commercial production is far different than in the 1950s.
That's Scott Bayer, the Extension's poultry expert at Kansas State University.
Heritage turkey must be able to reproduce naturally. No artificial insemination is allowed. It has to do more with the genetics and adhering to what a turkey is supposed to be.
The heritage turkey still has all its natural abilities, like flying and mating. But Bear says the commercial turkey has been bred to produce more meat in a shorter amount of time to meet the demand of the modern consumer.
Consumers wanted boneless, skinless meat. And the best cut is the boneless, skinless portion of the breast. And so if you're a geneticist, then you've greatly improved the muscle yield off the breast meat off a turkey, because that is the part that returns you the most profit.
Back on the farm, the place feels a bit empty, with only a few hundred birds running around. It's 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, and Reese has just sold his flock for the season. 4,000 birds were shipped off to a distributor in New York, where these birds will sell for more than $80 each.
I did an interview for a lady out of New York, and she said, "Do you realize that some people here in New York pay as much as $200 for one of your turkeys?" And I told her, I says, "That might be true. But," I said, "of that $200, I get 22 of it."
Because Reese is a small, independent farmer, he says the money goes to paying for processing, trucking, and shipping.
I've got to feed the parents, hatch the baby, raise the baby. So when I get finished, I might make $5 per turkey.
To help pay for his turkey farm, Reese has a day job as a nurse anesthetist.
For me, it's all about the birds. The first motivation is, and this is probably the hardest thing for people to understand, is my pure love for them.
Unlike most farmers who take satisfaction in feeding people, Reese says he'd just rather focus on the breeding and the conservation of his birds.
I hate killing my birds. The day we load them for Thanksgiving is traumatic for me. I hate it because I've known them since, you know, they're eggs. But I don't have any other way of generating any money to preserve them, to save their lives.
Keeping these birds around is important to Reese, but he wonders who will care for them once he's gone.
This is probably my biggest concern I have, is what is going to happen. I'm going to be the end of it in my family. You know, none of my nephews or nieces or great nephews and nieces, none of them are going to come back here and farm. And I just keep hoping someday, someplace, somebody's going to hear this and they're going to say, you know, this cause is worth preserving.
Reese has been raising turkeys for nearly 60 years and hopes that by continuing to promote his birds, he can help save the tradition of the heritage turkey. For Casey Currents, I'm Esther Honig.
Last weekend was a homecoming for Kansas City, Kansas native Janelle Monáe, a rising star in soul and hip-hop music. In fact, next month she'll receive Billboard's Rising Star Award. Monáe's recently collaborated with Erykah Badu and Prince. She had her first local headliner at the Uptown Theater on Friday night. It was a boisterous, sold-out party attended by dozens of her family members and former teachers. They keep us underground, working hard for the greedy. But when it's time to pay, they turn around and call us needy. My crown too heavy like the Queen Nefertiti. Give me back my pyramid, I'm trying to free Kansas City. The show highlighted Janelle Monáe's eclectic blend of science fiction and urban realism. Her dead-on vocals, dance skills, and stage antics made her seem like a reincarnation of Michael Jackson or James Brown. She's also known for her androgynous, tuxedo-inspired outfits and signature pompadour, which don't stop her from being a cover girl. Before her show last week, Monáe sat down with John Hart at KCPT's studios. Today on KC Currents, we're bringing you some excerpts from their conversation.
When I was researching, one of the things that really surprised me was nowhere in the 45 pages of material did Of Montreal get mentioned.
Oh, really?
And the other thing that didn't get mentioned surprised me even more, which was your turn in the song from Fun. And I just thought, wow, she's got so much going on that these things are just dropping off
really?
The radar.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Sometimes you've got to sort of shake your head and say...
Yes, absolutely. There are still certain things that I'm just like, wow, I can't believe that I get the opportunity to be here right now. And you know, I can't believe that I'm meeting this person and doing these things. And so it's truly already been an amazing journey. And this is still feels like the beginning of my career. You know, of course, long before I put out, you know, the Arc Android, my first full-length project, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, you know, working as an independent artist, selling CDs out of my boarding house. I lived with six other girls and working at Office Depot and you know, living paycheck to paycheck, but so passionate about my career and so passionate about being an artist. And I'm just so thankful that, you know, I have a support system like Kansas City, like my family still. And I try to make the most of all these opportunities. You know, I try and say something profound or build with these powerful people that I'm meeting. You know, I was talking to you off camera about providing a performing arts school here in Kansas City, Kansas. That is something that I really am passionate about, and there's an urgency.
Can you tell me about the weirdos?
Oh, my God. How do you know about the weirdos? Shout out to Marlon and Brandon and everybody who was a part of the weirdos, the group. I would sing with them and perform with them at various talent showcases. And, you know, we were really avant-garde, just individuals. And when I say that, you know, there was a section of Kansas City who, majority of people, they were singing and they were rapping other people's music. And I was one of them. I would do a lot of cover songs. But the weirdos wrote their music and, you know, were very political about what they wanted to see done differently and had a very unique approach. So I will say being a part of them and just kind of touring with them around Kansas City helped me to discover my inner weirdo,
yeah,
if you will.
When just the slight mentions that I got of them made me think that maybe it kind of a little bit of it started there.
It did. I mean, here in Kansas City is where I cultivated a lot of my style and my individuality. I remember, you know, my parents couldn't afford to buy me every expensive new thing that came out as far as clothes were concerned and shoes and new Jordans and all that, whatever was cool in school. So what I would do was I would go on Westport and I would go to thrift stores or consignment shops and I would get coats and I would get shoes. And I was more interested in having the most unique outfit. You know, I never wanted to fit in. I would go buy those cat glasses and, you know, people would look at me like, you know, going to class in school, like, what is she doing? But I was cultivating my style long before today.
You know, your folks might not have had a lot, but your mother was very fierce and very determined.
Yes.
And at the drop of a hat, she would load you into that two-door
yes.
Dodge.
How do you know about this? Yes, my mom had this two-door Dodge, and I would never forget how we would travel. I mean, you could fit. This was a two-door, small, like Flintstones-looking car, and my friends would spend the night and go to my talent showcases. So you have like at least eight kids packed in the back. We're sitting on laps. This is all illegal. Don't ever do this. We're sitting on laps. Four people in the front. Like it is just. Even though she was working hard, she always made sure that I had a nice talent show outfit, that I had a nice cassette CD with my instrumental on it, and, you know, that we looked our best.
You've mentioned the coterie many times.
I have, yes.
You became a bit of a writer starting there.
I did. In school, I was in English AP, and, you know, honors English, and I would write a lot. My teacher, Mrs. Appleberry, who I had the opportunity to see today, I went to go speak at my old alma mater, my old high school, F.L. Schlegel High School, and she really encouraged me to just write from your heart, and she had such a unique and interesting way of teaching that it always made me want to write and be great at it. And so I took that, you know, over into acting, and the programs that I got into with the Young Playwrights, the Round Table, I want to say that's the name of it, where I would go and, you know, just write short stories and fellowship with other writers and actors. And then I did Shakespeare at Wyandotte High School. And so, you know, the Coterie Theater was so instrumental in helping me hone my craft as a writer.
You went to work doing as a maid at one point to help fund your education in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And you're originally thinking musical theater, but my impression is that, you know, the musical theater thing, you know, you really needed more than performing somebody else's work.
Absolutely. Now I'm doing it, but just on my own terms. I've always, again, I've been a writer. I've had these ideas. I love science fiction. I love telling stories using science fiction. And I remember growing up, I would watch Star Wars and Star Trek, and I would watch all these things with my grandmother. Yeah, and so I was just inspired to write, you know, this musical or this theme that dealt with Kansas City, but in the future, you know. And I knew that I needed to focus on that, and I needed to have a clear mind and really take that risk and truly be diligent about writing my own work.
Ooh, you shake it, baby. Electric lady, you're a star. You got a classic kind of crazy, but you know just who you are. You got the look.
The Electric Lady, the new CD, is an extension of the first CD in its own way, but the message just keeps coming back to female empowerment,
yes.
The disenfranchised, the marginalized in society. Yeah. I know you spent time today at your old high school.
Mm-hmm.
How was that experience for you?
Emotional. It was so emotional visiting, you know, because they're sitting in the same gymnasium that I sat in, that I listened to, and listened to people come in and speak, you know, to us. And it is, you know, I always get nervous about those events because I have so much to say and I want something to resonate. I want them to feel more empowered. I want them to be more encouraged. And you just want to make sure you can get it all out and, you know, you're not talking down to them because teenagers sometimes they're kind of hard. You know, I know I was. It's just like you have to have a unique way of approaching them for them to really get it. And I just pray that everything I said resonated. And it was a great time. My old teachers were there, Mrs. Appleberry, my English teacher, and Mr. Ammons, my music teacher, and so many of the people who helped me become the person that I am. And like I told them, I wish I would have listened more, you know, in high school. I wish I would have. I wish I would have focused a little bit more. That's why I'm an artist, because I'm a little, you know, crazy at times. But had I just focused just a little bit more, I probably would be doing three things instead of two.
Yeah. The Electric Lady is in stores now on Atlantic Records, and the two-disc version is at Target. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
That's it for Casey Currents for today. Our live broadcast is now every Thursday morning. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or subscribe to the podcast, check out our page at kcur.org. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter @KaseyCurrents. Central Standard is back tomorrow with the history of streetcars in Kansas City. Next hour on Up to Date, Steve Kraske will be revisiting the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Today's Casey Currents was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Alex Smith, and Lori Arbor, with help from Esther Honig, Ross Steinmetz, and Sydney Llewellyn. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.